some support from Mr. Milliken, who I believe is online.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, I can.
Yes, I'm here too. Brian will be leading this discussion with help from Eric Mattson.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Brian Galvez. I'm a gear researcher at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center with the gear research team under Henry Milliken and Eric Mattson. And I'm here today to raise awareness and engage mobile fishermen, anybody who uses bottom tending gear, on visualizing on-demand or ropeless or buoyless gear positions. And to avoid any confusion, I'm just going to be using the term on-demand for the rest of the presentation. This presentation is part of our unintended series of talks regarding on-demand fishing research and development. In June of last year, Henry Milliken provided an overview of our research collaboration with fishermen and gear manufacturers. In September, Dr. Asaro provided an overview on the draft ropeless roadmap. And today I'm here to engage the mobile fleet on visualizing ropeless gear positions, or on-demand gear positions, I should say. I have three primary goals for today's talk. The first is to raise awareness of the upcoming EFP activities in two vertical line closures offshore of Rhode Island and Massachusetts. The second is to explain how to visualize on-demand gear positions. And the third, again, is to request engagement of the mobile fleet to test, evaluate, and provide feedback on virtual gear marking systems. The core issue at hand here is the recent 2021 amendment to the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Plan, which includes closures to persistent vertical buoy lines. The closures are provided here in the image here, as well as the dates. But for now, we are primarily focused on the South Islands restricted area and the Massachusetts restricted area, which are closed from February 1st through April 30th. Because these areas are only closed to vertical lines, the solution for the fixed gear industry to continue fishing in these areas is to use on-demand fishing gear. And for those of you who are unfamiliar, on-demand gear is technology that removes the persistent vertical line out of the water column and makes it available on demand via acoustic release technology. But it is important to note, as Colleen stated in her previous talk, that fishing without an end line, no matter what type of gear, requires an exempted fishing permit because of that surface buoy requirement. Because of the intent to allow the use of on-demand gear to give fishermen access to these vertical line closures, the Northeast Fisheries Science Center recently put out a draft roadmap to a fully realized ropeless fishing system, entitled the Draft Ropeless Roadmap. The strategy is pretty simple, and it consists of the four steps as laid out here, but I'm here today to discuss the first two, and that's the technology development and testing and resolving gear conflict. And it's imperative that we solve these first two steps before moving on to the last two. Now, in terms of those first two steps, technology development and testing and resolving gear conflict, I'm showing you this diagram because we believe that it's important to get the message across that the gear research team is dedicated to working with fishermen throughout the entire process of gear research and development. So this here is our typical gear research flow chart, which outlines that process. We also understand that fishermen know best in solving problems in ways that work for them, and so it's important that fishermen have ownership in those solutions. For the past few years, we've been engaged in actions 3 through 5 with fishermen and manufacturers. That's gear design, pilot study, and gear testing. And beginning in February, we'll begin action 6 with the experimental fishery. So recognizing the complexity of the problem and the rapid development of the technologies, these actions will need to continue concurrently for the next several years to best serve the industry. We know that this system will not be ready overnight. So this is where we're at right now, and it's going to inform us on how we'll get to where we need to go. This is a slide showing the scope of the research. Very brief information here. It just puts some numbers on what fishermen have accomplished over the past few years. The trials are occurring in lobster management areas 1, 2, 3, and 5. The majority of the gear has been configured as hybrid trawls with one standard compliant buoy line on one end and an on-demand system on the other. And what I'd like you to get from this is the expansion of vessels between fishing years. This just shows the increased by fixed gear fishermen, the increased interest by fixed gear fishermen to use this gear to access those vertical line closures. So like I mentioned, the next phase of testing is the experimental fishery. And this year we'll be having 13 vessels operating up to 10 fully ropeless trawls from February through April in the South Islands and the Massachusetts restricted area closures. We're expecting 7 vessels in the South Islands area and 6 in the mass restricted area. So up to 70 ropeless in the South Islands and up to 60 fully ropeless trawls in the Massachusetts restricted area. And again, one of the main target audiences here today are mobile gear vessels that use bottom tending gear that fish or steam through these areas during the closure periods. So I've touched on what the gear is, how we work with fishermen to make it their own, the scope of the research, and the upcoming experimental fishery. And now I think it's a good idea for everyone to see for themselves how the technology actually works. This is a video I'm about to show you that shows how the EdgeTech system works, which is the system that our EFP participants will be using this year. And I should point out that EdgeTech is one of a handful of available on-demand systems. This brand, as well as Smelts and DBV, has also been proven by fishermen to be suitable for the experimental fishery. And I'm going to try and narrate this as it plays, so you guys can go ahead and play it. So the tablet that you see on the top left is the application that you're able to operate the gear with. Right now he's deploying a trawl, so he selects the trap line. That tablet has his GPS information recording, and once it picks up his location, the crew will send off the first trap in that trawl. It records a position on that first button push. So as the trawl eventually gets laid out, he gets ready for that last trawl to go overboard, and then he hits the finish button on the application there. That trawl line is then mapped on a charts page within that application, and the time and coordinates are recorded in a database as well as displayed on the that particular unit's page. So now you can navigate to the charts page. It's linked up with Navionics, and he's able to zoom in on his location, and you can see the trawl that he just put out, and he has another trawl that's in parallel that he put out recently. And he can click on those pins, and it will show him the coordinates. And then this is just a recovery. He steams up to his trawl that he'd like to recover. He could click on the pin and it'll show him the unit number ID. And he goes over to the underwater units page and selects that particular unit that he'd like to recover. Once he's there, he has a transducer that he can put into the water, but right now I should say he has a hull-mounted transducer, so he doesn't have to dunk this dunking transducer anymore. So it's, now it's simply the press of a button for him to trigger the gear. So once he presses the recover button, a signal is sent. A coded message is sent to that particular unit, which asks it to release its line and buoys. It takes about 15 to 30 seconds, I believe. And once it is triggered, he receives a feedback message saying that I'm coming up, and then he just waits for it to come up. And then it's pretty much like normal fishing after that. This particular type of gear is a stowed line, we call it. So it basically just uses a rope locker or a basket. He repacks it with the rope. The crew will stick the door with the buoys on it and get it ready to go back out. And that's it. You can move on to the next. Here we go. So this is the crux of my presentation. It's actually viewing the virtual gear marks to avoid gear conflict. Like you just saw in the video, the Trap Tracker app allows fixed gear fishermen with EdgeTech units to operate EdgeTech gear. But it also allows other users of the app to view gear within a 2.5 mile radius. So as you steam, those trawl positions will appear when you're within 2.5 miles and will disappear when you're outside of 2.5 miles from a particular gear location. How a mobile gear fisherman would use this is to first connect to Wi-Fi at the dock, or if they have the app on their phone, just open up the app, navigate to the charts page like you see there, and hit the update button. When you do that, that downloads gear position data from a 25-mile radius based on your position. As you steam out to your fishing grounds or are planting your tow based on the gear field around you, the virtual trawl locations are automatically added and removed within that 2.5-mile display radius as your position changes within that 25-mile download zone. That's the basic functionality of the app. But it is important to know that if you go past that 25-mile radius, internet connectivity is required to update an additional 25 miles. But if you're close to shore and you have cell service, you can turn on your hotspot and connect to Wi-Fi, or again, if you're using your phone, just hit the update button and another 25 miles of gear positions will be downloaded. And it's, we're thinking best practice. If you know where you're going to lose service, simply hit the update button right before that and you'll get more data to be downloaded and to be viewed. And I should also mention that we have just asked EdgeTech to increase that 25-mile download into a 50-mile radius. So that would be 100 miles of gear position data to be downloaded within that update button push. And then you'll still be able to see 2.5 miles of gear within that 2.5 mile radius. And the only reason for that is for privacy. You can't just open the app and be able to see everyone's gear out there. So far from talking with a few mobile guys and just common sense, the main benefits of an app like this are, one, that it removes the guesswork from determining a set direction and length from a single surface buoy. And two, that you can see the trawl locations in thick fog, heavy seas, and at night, anytime there's poor visibility. And I will say, some fishermen have said, that we've talked to, have said that this would be better than a surface buoy. So you can take that as you will. I should also note that there are other solutions besides Trap Tracker in development. We are looking into leveraging the VMS platform and tablets, but we're still in early stages there. But right now, the Trap Tracker is the best thing that we have so far. But it certainly isn't a done deal. The EdgeTech company and other companies are taking our recommendations and requests seriously, and we are working on a better product all the time. So to conclude, the gear research team is looking for interested fishermen who operate bottom tending mobile gear within or near the two closed areas that I mentioned, South Islands and Mass Restricted Area, to use the Trap Tracker app during the closure period. We're also looking for feedback from the industry regarding what information that you believe should be required to go along with the gear location coordinates. So permit number, vessel name, things like that. That's very important to us. We'd like to hear from you. And also, if you're, we'd also want to know what you think is a reasonable minimum distance to view a virtual trawl position to avoid gear conflict. So is 2.5 miles enough? Do you need more? Please tell us. So if you're interested in using the app or simply giving us feedback on these two questions I just posed, please contact us or see us after this session to discuss details. Eric and I will be here for the rest of the day. And with that, I should acknowledge all of the fishing industry collaborators, all the gear manufacturers, the state partners, our federal partners, and the NGO community. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for your presentation. I'm going to go to the public first, see if we have any questions. Several people in the audience have some time stress today. So, Mr. Cotone. One of you is going to have to move.
Al Cotone, bottom trawl fisherman from Gloucester, Mass. First of all, I realize that we're early in this technology, but downloading an app on a phone is not going to get it done. I mean, our cell service comes in and out once you get more than 5-6 miles offshore. And once we move along into this and there are more participants, I'm a little familiar with lobster fishermen, and they use other lobstermen's buoys to find out how close they can set to other guys, depending on how the lobsters are migrating. So not being able to see a buoy is detrimental to other lobstermen setting close to potential competitors. And when these AFP areas are picked, mobile gear fishermen have to be at the front of the table, because we're dealing with enough closures right now that when you pick an area to start doing these experiments, it basically becomes a closure for mobile gear fishermen. So we would like to be at the table when these areas are picked and for these experiments. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Mr. Mankiewicz.
Drew Mankiewicz, the Fishery Survival Fund. I work with the scallop industry. A few questions on this. So the trap locations require the captain to manually input the beginning and the end of the trawl, correct?
That's correct.
All right, so that's one particular. How do they get removed?
Once they hit the recover button and they retrieve the gear, it gets removed.
It automatically deletes, yeah. Okay. And then as far as the range for the download, scallop industry has mandated fishing grounds where they have to go to access area trips, specific locations, but the fleet is home ported from Maine to North Carolina. So someone can be leaving from Hampton Roads area and fishing off of Georgia's Bank. And so the 50 mile, or they will not see the trap locations in that scenario. And that's a common scenario in the scallop fishery. So that's problematic. I also worry about, is there any link between verification of a trap being deployed and a captain being able to mark an area? So, could you put out dummy, you know, could you mark an area that say there's a trap there, but there's not actually a trap there? Is that possible?
It is possible, but the people we're working with right now aren't incentivized.
Yeah, I understand that, but when it goes widely used, that's an easy game to see being played.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is problematic. And then also, you know, there's many different gear technologies being used than I can imagine. There's going to be many different apps. And so no mobile guy is going to have to want to download 4 different apps. I mean, depending on neck enough just to text between a Samsung and an iPhone, like, we don't need to make this of that nature, right? So there needs to be some kind of universal interface if this is going to work. That has to be mandated. Happy to continue. These are my initial thoughts. I have many more thoughts, but happy to continue the conversation.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the audience? Mayor LaPointe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George LaPointe with Blue Harvest Fisheries. Following up on Drew's comment a little bit, the 25 or the 50 miles is problematic. Blue Harvest roams all over George's Bank, and it strikes me that you could expand that range without using up a lot of computer memory and by protecting people's location, because Blue Harvest doesn't care if it's the chairman's traps or Tom Neese's traps, they care where the traps are. And so you could protect confidentiality, have a much bigger geographic area to try to accomplish, you know, knowing where those traps are. Thank you.
Ms. Fuller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, council members, and thank you, Brian, for the presentation. I think there's an expectation from Congress that ropeless fishing is going to be a much bigger component of this 2028 rule than it perhaps would have been for the 2024 rule. And although we're talking about apps now that maybe can go 25 or 50 miles, I think there are other technologies that are on the horizon that perhaps it might be helpful if Brian spoke briefly about, and if you wanted to talk or perhaps speak to Earth Ranger or what we have heard is really promising technology from Starlink RV, things like that might be great for the council to hear that there's more than just this app coming up in the next near future.
Right. Erica is talking about our collaboration with an Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. They have a subsidiary called Earth Ranger, which is a nonprofit that integrates data streams from multiple different companies. So like people were saying, EdgeTech is one company. There are other companies with their own applications. So Earth Ranger is able to integrate all the data into their own system and send that data back out so that anybody using any app is going to be able to see everybody's gear from all those different applications, if that makes sense. And they're also working on their own. There's a potential for them to work on their own application, or if we do end up getting some sort of funding to make our own application for whatever purposes, for regulators and management and potentially mobile fishermen as well.
Hey, anybody else from the audience? Yes, sir.
Are these apps thanks. Exclusive to Excuse Lightning me, Man Fishing? Robert Wait. Nudd? Are these apps exclusive to on-demand fishing, or can they be utilized also in a grappling situation?
Right now they're exclusive to on-demand fishing, but I think that we could probably end up configuring them to a grappling situation to mark gear.
Thank you.
Anybody else in the public? Mr. O'Neill.
Jerry O'Neill with Endeavor and Challenge out of Gloucester. I'm curious, I can see a lot of, obviously it's new to us, so I can see a lot of problems with it. I want to echo what Al had said about mobile gear fishermen being heavily involved in the development of whatever gets used. But I'm curious if there's technology that either currently exists on vessels or could be put on mobile gear vessels rather than an app that could detect the gear. Some of the problems I can see are internet connectivity. That's a huge issue that I don't know how you're going to overcome that. But if there was something that either equipment or technology that could be put on the mobile gear vessels to detect the gear through active fishing when you're fishing, when you're going to fish for whatever you're fishing for.
There was some consideration about having mobile guys have the hydrophones to be able to detect them acoustically, but the ranges that you would need to detect these things would probably be too close for you guys, for the mobile fishermen, to be able to detect them at a sufficient distance to avoid gear conflict, especially if you're not going around in an area. But we just don't think it's highly expensive to add hydrophones to and require that. We don't.
Internet connectivity on fishing vessels that are fishing in Georges is highly expensive as well. Right. I just think that should be looked into a little bit more because, I mean, right now, if you're fishing in an area with lobster gear, you're using the buoys as an indication. Right. You're pretty close. You're pretty close then.
Right.
So anyway, I just think it's something that should be looked at.
We're looking into it. Thank you.
Brian, can I jump in quickly?
Please.
So just I hope that the audience realizes this is still in the infancy. I heard a question about, the gear marking and whether or not somebody could place the gear just by pushing a pin. Our goal is eventually to have RFID tags so that the button pushes will be eliminated. And eventually, our goal is to move this so that the visualization of this gear is on the vessel's chart plotters. We're working with multiple efforts to make that happen. We have contracts with companies who are looking to integrate into the chart plotters. And so what you're seeing today is where we're situated right now. We've recognized, many of these concerns, and we continually look to the industry to present us concerns. And then we're bringing those concerns to the engineering and the manufacturing community to help us resolve them. So I'm just letting people know that what you're seeing today is kind of the preliminary test. We're trying to do this to get this stuff out this year to show that we can work successfully in inshore waters in areas where cell phone coverage is sufficient. And then as time progresses, we completely anticipate that the technology will improve to a point where we can address these concerns about, being able to see the gear further offshore outside of cell phone range, integrating with the fishermen's electronics, et cetera, to help mitigate these concerns. So I'll leave it at that, but thank you.
Okay, very good. I'm going to bring it back to the council. I'm going to start with Mr. Bellavance and then Mr. Tracy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Brian, for your presentation. So the focus of all your work has been on the mobile gear fleet, but I also want to raise awareness of another user group in these areas, that's the recreational fishery, and how historically we use those same buoys to figure out where the fishing gear is so that we drift along and we don't catch all of our hooks and jigs and things like that on that gear. So I'm looking at the different time area closures, and a lot of the recreational fishery won't be on the water that time, but the for-hire fleet would be in many instances, the bigger party boats and so on. So there might be an opportunity here to reach out to a few of those permit holders to get their thoughts and maybe incorporate them in the design of future applications, and that could be applied to the whole recreational fishery later. So just a suggestion. Thank you.
Mr. Tracy, then Mr. Salerno.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Really quickly, and you probably know this, but I know this is about mobile gear, but obviously a huge source of gear conflict is fixed gear users laying over each other, setting over each other. And the issues here, one of the things that's jumping out in the presentation is how similar the issues are between notification issues. And I'm sure you're aware of that. I want to say, but I could see this being really useful in as the development of the app goes and creating alarms and alerts when people are too proximate to each other, and I think that would be an upside, quite honestly, for the for some of the fixed gear users. Thanks.
Mr. Salerno, then Ms. Ware.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Galvez, for the presentation. This is great to see that you guys are engaging with the mobile fleet. Just a few thoughts here. I won't go into the connectivity. I think that's you got a pretty good hash of what the issue is there. One of the issues I could see potentially see is accuracy of these positions data. I'm assuming it's based on whatever the vessel's GPS unit is. While they are fairly accurate, there is no calibration of individual units from one vessel to another. So one person's position here may be someone else's position of the exact same numbers, not in the same spot. So I'm a little concerned with calibrating between, intercalibration between a lot of vessels with their GPS units. Another concern I'm seeing is once a vessel, a lobster vessel sets gear, the upload frequency of that set. Is it instantaneous? Is it once he hits the dock? Is it, you know, so just that upload frequency into the database for other users to see. And just to kind of take one step further with Mr. Tracy's comment there is that we're not talking about just the mobile gear fleet. We're also talking about the other fixed gear. Gill nets, long lines, hand gears, jig gear. So just keep in mind that there's others beyond just the mobile fleet that we do need to connect with. And, you know, comments of the question you had is what would the industry like to see as type of non-proprietary information? I would go with what's ever on the buoy. And honestly, I don't know what is on the buoy, but I'm sure there's some kind of identifying information that really would be on the buoy that I think would be helpful to at least have available on these apps. Thank you.
Ms. Ware, then Ms. Eitri.
Thank you for the presentation. Acknowledging that this is an outreach meeting, can you guys talk about what other outreach you have done to people who use buoys either to navigate around gear or you know, for whatever their purposes are?
Yeah, so we got funding for FIS, which is the Fisheries Information System grant, internal grant, and I've organized several workshops with the different state agencies so far, from Rhode Island to Maine. And also we've held a workshop with the Atlantic Offshore Lobstermen's Association about this type of database and the database management and the different gear field or data fields that they need to see and know about. And then today. And Eric, can you?
Maybe just to put a finer point on the question, specific to the EFP testing of fully ropeless gear, what does the outreach look like?
Good. Sorry, I'll take a second to introduce myself. Eric Mattson, also of the Gear Research Team, Protected Species Branch, Northeast Fisheries Science Center. We reached out to our NOAA law enforcement, and we'll be issuing an email and noticed other law enforcement agencies through them that covers the areas and the areas where the gear will be, as well as what markings the gear will have, flags that the vessels will fly. And we're planning an email to permit holders through GARFO, sharing some of the same information.
Okay. So my read of the EFP is that potentially starts in a week. So I just want to flag that, you know, I feel like I'm pretty in tune with what's happening here. This was the first I had heard about this. So I'm not sure how strong the awareness is potentially in the industry that fully ropeless gear is being fished in a week, potentially. And if there is an expectation for other users to be downloading the EdgeTech app, you know, that may take time to familiarize themselves with, you know, how that operates or whatever. So, I would just encourage some pretty strong outreach in the next week to make sure that that's covered.
All set. Ms. Eitri, then Mr. Hansen.
Thanks. Just a general observation, not realizing that this was being deployed in a week, which is actually not, doesn't sit well just in the sense of notification. I would just say in the larger development of the CFP and what you're trying to accomplish, kind of thinking about what Ms. Fuller said about, like, you know, the goal trying to have this technology more fleshed out for 2028, One, I would strongly encourage you to have conversations with the mobile gear fishermen that have been in the room or the representatives in the room, and maybe think through if it's more effective if you could try to get work with them to get them. And I'm volunteering some folks that maybe giving me glares if I could see them, get them to work with their colleagues and get someone in the room and to have this conversation. So I think you'd have a much more robust conversation with them in a room than you are going to have with us around the table. And I would just also highlight something to think about, again, mapping into 2028, and if the goal is to try to have this as like a fully operational thing that could be deployed, I would turn, and I'm sorry to my Garfo and Science Center friends, I would turn to electronic monitoring the groundfish fishery for lessons learned on what not to do. One of them being, do not look at technology that becomes proprietary so that you have folks having to, in the groundfish fishery, if you want to change a provider, you have to incur the cost of changing the cameras, the equipment, and whatnot. And no one in the industry is going to sit there and have five different apps that they're opening to figure out where all the stuff is. It sounds like you're trying to get to a centralized platform, but I would really prioritize that because it's just, it will never be fully operational if you're expecting folks to have 20 apps. Or if you're making it even for the commercial lobstermen, a situation where it's not easy to change technology because they're so invested in one or the other. So that would be what I would think is it's a shortfall in the EM programs in groundfish that I wouldn't want to see happen here, having like the lack of ability for plug and play and having consistency. And I would just, again, reiterate, I know that currently it's probably not a concern with the EFP participants, but longer term operationalizing this, I think ensuring that the gear or the marking of the gear can't be used to closed areas off, like prime little honey spots to folks, is essential because it's a very real concern. And I think if you talk to some folks offline, they could pinpoint some times where they feel like that's happened. Thanks.
Mr. Hansen, then Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of problems I see with this, especially offshore. You know, internet connectivity is paramount. That's something that's really going to be a problem. Even if this satellite connectivity, you have to update it to the internet. The vessel that doesn't have the technology that wants to go out will only be able to download when they get to when they're at the dock. They'll be, and they're out for 2 weeks. There's a long period of time where this gear can be out there with no markings known to this vessel that's left the dock. So you have to have some kind of satellite connectivity for everyone, which is very, very expensive. And the other problem I see is you need oversight to make sure that the lobster fishermen don't mark preps that aren't there, because they very easily stake out an area for themselves, fill it with traps, and nobody will fish there because it'd be conflicts. So there has to be some oversight on how many traps get marked for each vessel. You know, and they can't put out ghost trawls that will deter mobile gear fishermen and other lobster fishermen from fishing the same area. Thanks.
If I could respond to some of this, all very good comments, and we're at a stage in the research and development with our fishermen collaborators that provides a platform for development, right? So in these vertical line closures that are coming up, these are experienced test pilots that are experienced with using the gear. It's in controlled, we consider them test ranges, where it's controlled competition with other fixed gear, and it provides a platform to accomplish some of these suggestions that you're pointing out. And we have with the fishermen developed proof of concept offshore real-time updates. It is with satellite Wi-Fi, and it's one way to do it. It may not be a long-term solution, but it's one way that we've demonstrated that it can be accomplished. And this platform allows a way to develop those technologies. And we're here today to get input and receive some of that input and have those offline discussions like Ms. Etri suggested. Thank you.
Yeah, the upload technology is great if it's satellite, but it would require everyone to download with satellite too, which gets very expensive for the whole fleet.
Dr. Hare, did you want to add to this?
Yeah, I just want to go back to Ms. Etri's question about the open source, and the ROPLESS roadmap is clear. It says it's critical that this geolocation system rely on open source rather than proprietary technology. So that is very much at the front of our mind. I think for all of us to remember that we want to work in an open source format would be important.
Okay, I have Mr. Pierdnak, then Mr. Olszewski, then I have a few questions, and then I'm going to go to Mr. Nice. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you both for your presentation. Your charts noted here indicate there's been ongoing studies here in Cape Cod Bay, off the tip of Cape Cod here, and noting the time of year, you know, as Rick noted earlier, the February to April time frame, there's likely not as many recreational anglers underwater, but maybe a greater likelihood of there being for hire vessels. How you then communicate to get the word out, you indicate you would email to permit holders to GARFO. Maybe as a possibility, you also email state permitted, who has state recreational fishing license in, for Massachusetts, to notify them as a mechanism to get that word out. Now, I just went on my phone here, and I think that the app was available. You have to pay for it, but maybe that's a mechanism that you notify via email, say that you can obtain it, and then that could be used as a mechanism to, as you said, because it's near shore, it can work, but it's at least in the initial phase. Also to point out, I mean, it's water temperatures are about 3-4 degrees higher, our seawater temperatures right now. They've historically been that way the past few years now, unfortunately, and now we have right whales that are arriving sooner. So in Cape Cod Bay. So when I look at February to April time frame, there's quite possibility that other fish, whether it's forage fish or fish that the recreational community targets, may show up sooner. Therefore, there may be people fishing out there in that time of year. So from a recreational standpoint, we're all anxiously waiting to see whether that's going to be the case, consistent with the water temperatures. But I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Mr. Olszewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple of questions. My first was if there were any companies that are sort of researching satellite-based technologies, and it sounded like, Eric, that you had provided an answer that I guess some of these companies are probably looking further down. We've heard from everyone that, you know, offshore fisheries that take place outside of cell ranges is not as much help. But my other question is regarding the mobile fleet, which is probably one of the most important parts of this whole puzzle. Like, what incentive is there for a mobile gear fisherman to jump into this program and say, well, it's not really my problem with whales, but, you know, short of a mandate, I guess, we need to somehow communicate, whether we do that through individual state listservs and things like that to the users, that fleet. But I feel like that's, you know, where we're at in this problem. I think the technology is going to advance over the next, you know, 5 years anyway, as everything does. But that's the key to this, is some kind of buy-in to these, the mobile fleet. So thank you.
I'll just respond. I'll let Brian speak to his FIS workshop in publication or document. But, yeah, we're looking into the possibilities of, so far with the research, we've allowed the research collaborator fishermen to place the gear in ways and in strategies that protect it, working with the mobile fishermen that they know. Even in Rhode Island, there's agreements that have unofficial agreements that they use, and we're working within those as much as possible, but also having the fishermen pilot the outreach on how they could work with their mobile industry in that area, right? When someone comes in from another area, that we lose the structure there. But We're looking at all those possibilities. I'll let Brian speak to the what might be accomplished as far as the unofficial agreements, documenting unofficial agreements.
We are working with the Coonamessett Farm Foundation to document existing agreements, gear marking agreements, you know, how different directions of the set, so we can get an idea of how best to approach the gear marking schemes that are currently in existence. But to address your point about incentives, we are working on how to figure that out, and you know, it's still kind of up in the air, and I would like to hear from Mobile Guys today about how to do that.
All set. Yeah, as far as the informal agreements, the zeros and fives, you're talking about zeros and fives. Yeah, that's all well and good until somebody comes in and decides they don't like zeros and fives. That's a fact. So I have a lot of my questions have already been asked, but and you can answer them later. But, you know, the position is based on when the trap goes over to stern. So that, how far do those pots move from that location? Those things move. And I don't know how far they move, but that'd be something to figure out, because if you think they're there and they're not, it's going to be trapless fishing. So, and I don't know what the recovery rate versus lost gear is in this particular exercise. There was some testing of it off of New Jersey, and I think the recovery rate was about 50%. Which is not good, but you can answer those questions later, and I have a bunch of other stuff, but I want to move this along, so I'm going to turn to Mr. Neese, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to kind of connect a few dots that were mentioned during the discussion today, and also bring up some an issue that the regional administrator brought up at the executive committee meeting, so I'm probably going to turn to him for a little help here in just a minute. But at the executive committee meeting, Mr. Pentney suggested that given the 2028 timeline, which it appears is going to have an increased role for on-demand or ropeless gear fishing, that there may be a role for the council to facilitate discussions on how to minimize, I don't know whether I want to use the term gear conflicts, but let's say gear interactions between mobile gear fishing and ropeless fishing that goes on. Now, I said mobile because that's primarily what we talked about, but obviously today we identified some other possibilities that need to be addressed as well. And so I'll turn to Mr. Pentney and let him elaborate a little bit, and then I'll come back to me, I guess, and maybe suggest a possible approach to see if the council is willing to consider that.
Thanks. So what we talked about at the executive committee was, you know, a couple of things. One was the sort of expected timeline for the next round of, or the next rule that would affect the lobster and Jonah crab fishery. And, you know, as already been pointed out, Colleen mentioned this, the Consolidated Appropriations Act set a deadline of December 31st, 2028 for us to have new regulations in effect for the Jonah crab and lobster fishery that are consistent with the ESA and the MMPA. So we would expect to have a proposed rule out probably sometime 2027 would be the, I think, my target, so that we can have something in effect at the end of 2028. So that means we're going to be working on a rule over the next few years that's going to be looking at a wide range of things that the TRT has already discussed. And while, you know, it's impossible to say now what exactly that rule will look like, I feel fairly certain to say that ropeless is going to play a significant role in that, either as an alternative to closed areas or something else. And so these issues, and there's been a really good discussion today and a lot of good questions and concerns raised about the implications if one gear type, one sector, the lobster fishery, is using ropeless tech or on-demand tech. What are the implications for all of the other fisheries that are out sharing the water and focusing on their efforts, whether it's the mobile gear fleet, gillnet fleet, other lobster fleet or vessels, for-hire vessels. So there's a lot of issues that need to be resolved and brought up, and, you know, we can't we can't address everything or ask all the questions and get answers to all the questions in, you know, an hour or two at an occasional council meeting. So, you know, Sam and I are talk with you know, others, and one of the things that we noticed, and I've talked with Tom about this, and we talked about this at the executive committee, there is a provision in council FMPs for a gear conflict, and it's gear conflict, but it's gear conflict committee or advisory panel that could be established by the council. And so my recommendation was that the council sort of reinvigorate that process. It hasn't really been in effect for a number of years, but the plans do allow for it. So that would create a, you know, a framework, a venue for these discussions like we've had today to go into more depth and engage with the industry, engage with council members, think about the implications for the council's FMPs, whether it's changing rules around requiring end lines and gear marking, or whether it's addressing things like the looking at the technology, getting more in-depth presentations like we had today, bringing advisory panel members in from the various fisheries. It would create a venue and a forum for those discussions to occur over the next several years. So as we work through this and as the technologies evolve, because I do believe they will, we are able to work and engage directly with the industries that are going to be affected and come up with some solutions so that by 2027, when we are looking to have a proposed rule on the street, we fully understand the implications and have solutions available to address these questions and the concerns that have been initially raised today.
Mr. Denise.
So the regional administrator saved me a lot of work. So I guess the thing that the, you know, the council needs to sort of decide is whether this sounds like a good idea or not. As he pointed out, as Mike pointed out, we do have a gear conflict amendment that we adopted a long time ago. It outlines in broad terms a structure where we can establish a gear conflict committee or an ad hoc committee to deal with gear issues. So what the executive committee kicked around and is looking for feedback on is the idea of having a gear conflict committee, standing it up sometime in the not distant future, but not like tomorrow. So let's say sometime later this spring, and have that serve as a forum to address the issues that some of you brought up and that Mr. Pentney highlighted. So I think the chair is looking for feedback on whether that's a good idea or not.
That's exactly what the chair is looking for at this point. I have Dr. Hare, and then I'm going to go to Ms. Eitri.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. You referenced a 50% recovery rate from some early work off of New Jersey, and I was wondering if Mr. Mattson could talk about what the current recovery rate that you're seeing in the work that you're doing.
Sure, I could quickly answer that question. We're not familiar with any trials off of New Jersey. We haven't been a part of any New Jersey trials, but in our trials, which cover Maine to Rhode Island and then one fisherman in Maryland, we're seeing a 91% success rate of the on-demand gear among all brands. And as far as gear loss, we've lost very little gear. One is being looked for at the moment by a collaborator fisherman, but as far as gear retrieval, the gear has been recovered through the hybrid trawl or through the on-demand system. So we haven't lost gear because of the trials. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So to the question on whether or not the gear conflict working group is a good idea from the council, Ms. Eitri.
So I have a clarifying question, and then depending on the answer, I have some thoughts. Not knowing what the current workbook standards say about this gear conflict group, is it comprised of council members? Is it a working group where we could do a solicitation so it's a combination of council members and industry? What the recommendation to have a group, I get, but what is the group comprised of, or what is it envisioned the group is comprised of? Whom, not what, sorry.
So I think that's up to the council. In the past, it was a council committee made up of council members.
Go ahead, Libby.
To be really direct. I think it would be very short-sighted and possibly hinder the really critical discussions that need to occur if this group was limited to council members. I think you need to find folks that have the on-the-water experience, and I understand there are council members that have that on-the-water experience. I'm not trying to minimize it, but I think we really need to be targeting a much more robust demographic than what the council is comprised of to get the type of engagement I think we're going to need, and what this research, the EFP research, is going to need to evolve it from an EFP to an implementing. So maybe like a combination council member, what was it, industry-funded monitoring amendment working group, where it was a combination of both. That would be my recommendation. And also because I think this type of group is going to have to really dig into the weeds and come to the table prepared to have in-depth conversations. And I feel like that might be more constructive if we turn to some of the folks that have said, and I know one of them had to leave, that they want to have a seat at the table, that it would be probably more effective to have them at the table.
Mr. Penny.
Yeah, I think, to Tom's point, or to addressing your question, it is up to the council, but at least the regulations sort of envision either or, it's or both. It's the Standing Industry Advisory Committee or Ad Hoc Committee on Gear Conflict shall hold public meetings. So I think there's an opportunity for there to be a council committee so that the council members are directly engaged in the conversations, but also to engage with an advisory panel in the typical format that the council uses their advisory panel members.
Mr. Pappalardo, then Ms. Griffin.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we're looking at the need for more than one group of folks. I mean, the council itself ultimately will have to take information in and formulate regulations around that. But to me, the real nuts and bolts of this is a much more technical and on-the-water experiential conversation, and I just want to make sure that we don't think exclusively about New England and New England management plans, but consider the Mid-Atlantic as well. So I guess I would favor people that work with the gear, people that fish in all the different fisheries, to be the majority of the population of the working group, have a subset of council members, either a joint sub council, Mid-Atlantic New England members, or just New England members, when it comes time to receive that information and those recommendations and explore regulation. Thanks.
Ms. Denise, then Ms. Griffin.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe it'll shorten the discussion a little bit if what we do here today is we agree that we think there should be some form of group, and then we can come back in April with a proposed structure for the group to address these concerns. I mean, I can see a lot of ways to get input from on the water people besides giving them a seat at the table, right? That's one way. But why don't we do that approach rather than try and resolve it here? Unless Mr. Pentney thinks this group needs to get up and running like within the next month or two, which I don't think you do, because I don't think you said that at the executive committee meeting.
Yeah, I think having something ready to go shortly after the April meeting would be fine.
Ms. Griffin, then Ms. Patterson.
Mr. Neese just went where I was thinking that I strongly agree with Ms. Eitri and Mr. Pappalardo about the expansiveness in terms of the technical expertise we need here, but also needing the management body, and whether that's our typical committee AP structure or working group. As long as we allow for that broad representation, I reiterate the need for the Mid-Atlantic and the recreational representation. And I think allowing time to perfect that structure will also help allow us to align the resources that's going to support this, both in terms of funding and staff time.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Patterson, then Mr. Pierdnock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was going to go in the direction that Tom went. But there was conversation about, I think Mr. Pappalardo brought this up about the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council also. But we have to keep in mind that